This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Federal Premium Ammunition and their new centerfire rifle ammunition, Terminal Ascent. Now, the Terminal Ascent has a slipstream polymer tip that helps flatten trajectories and initiates low-velocity expansion at longer ranges. The Terminal Ascent gives you match-grade long-range accuracy in a bonded hunting bullet, and it comes in a variety of cartridges, including the 6.5 Creedmoor, the 280 Ackley Improved, the 28 Nosler, the 7mm Remington Mag 30-06, and the 300 Win Mag. If you want to find more information about the Terminal Ascent, visit federalpremium.com, and while you're there, check out It's Federal Season, the official podcast of Federal Ammunition. All right, on the phone with me today, Mr. Kent Boucher. Kent, how you doing, man?
Doing great, man. I'm really enjoying this mild weather we have here in Iowa. We don't have that corn sweat going on yet that we're going to have in about a month.
What do they say? Like the National Weather Service says that because of all the agriculture in the state of Iowa, it actually adds 1 to 2 degrees to the heat index because of the humidity that the crops give off throughout the summertime.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And that's crazy.
We just have such a different landscape between now and July and August.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, you know, Iowans are notorious about complaining about the weather, right? It's either too cold or it's too hot, right? Or there's too much snow. Or, you know, oh, the spring's going to suffer. We didn't get enough snow. You know, like, No one's ever happy with anything. And it's funny when I travel to different places, like, you know, here I am in Iowa. It's 85 degrees with maybe like 70% humidity. It's sticky outside. It's, you know, a little uncomfortable. Yep. We complain about that. And then I went down to New Orleans. I think it was like 2 summers ago. And you want to talk about humidity. It's just gross there. The humidity is just gross there. And then I go out to California, right? Northern California, where there's no humidity. And these people are like, oh man, it's cold outside and it's 75 degrees. I'm just like, what are you talking about? This is gorgeous out here. So
it's getting stuff done weather right
yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
Man.
Absolutely. Well, you recently wrote an article in the Iowa Sportsman magazine called 10 Disasters to Avoid with Your Gun Dog. And yep. Like I told you before I started recording,
I have absolutely no experience with hunting with dogs at all, other than going with someone who basically had a dog, right? My uncle, this was a long time ago, whether it was waterfowl or whether it was pheasant hunting. So that's what we're going to talk about today. But before we get into this episode, why don't you tell us where you're from and what do you do for a living?
Yeah. Well, my wife and I, we live over in the Quad City area in Davenport. And I actually am a high school biology teacher. As fate would have it, I teach in the classroom that I used to cause all sorts of problems in. And instead of getting yelled at by teachers, now I get to yell at kids. So,
okay, so I can remember back in elementary school, and I think it was even into high school, we would always play these tricks on these substitutes where the desks back then, you were able to lick your two fingers. And then there was like a book holder underneath of the desk, and you could rub them, and it would make these humming noises, just like and the substitute teachers were just like, what is going on in here? I'm like, and then so everybody in the classroom's in on it, right?
Yep.
And so we're just like, hey, just want to let you know, we've had this problem before. It's the lights. Got to get the maintenance crew in here and check the lights out. So the maintenance crew comes in. They're like, nothing seems wrong. You know, our hands are all on the desk. And then the second he walks out, we're all back to rubbing our desk, just blow. And then finally a teacher comes in and she's like, all right, everybody put your hands on your desk. And then it stopped. She's like, these kids are pulling your leg. Guys, if anybody does this, you're getting detention, whatever. So what are the, just out of curiosity, what are the tricks that kids try to pull on the teachers these days?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I've only been out of college for, let's see here, 6 or 7 years now. And, back at the start of it, cell phones were just kind of becoming like extra appendage, they've officially obtain that status, right? They're basically another body part on all of us.
Yeah.
But it was still like you kind of had to hide when you were texting or stuff. So the kids would kind of keep the phone like right down, kind of probably in that same area where you were licking your fingers and wiping it on the desk there, and just kind of hide their phone there, kind of tuck it under their leg and slide it out and send a snap or something like that. Every teacher's given up on that fight, right? So it's right there in broad daylight, and the kids are they're on them a lot, and you try to keep them focused, but basically it's gone from, yelling at kids for doing that kind of thing to finding a way to work around it and use it as a part of what productivity should be. But that would probably be the main one.
So,
some of those classic pranks, though, they're still circulating. They're still well used, especially on subs.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, the cell phone thing. Can't a teacher say, everybody put your cell phones in a basket and we can, you'll get them back at the end of class?
Yeah. There's some teachers that do that. Then we, maybe that's where coronavirus came from. Those phones are disgusting. I don't want to touch them.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel you. Well, teacher, man, better man than me, because I, everybody throughout my life has said, oh, Dan, you would be great at being a teacher. And I'm like, nuh-uh, I would not, because I would be that teacher who just starts telling kids, shut the F up, right? Just like, shut up. You're not smart. Yeah. You're dumb. You don't know nothing. You want to fight, I'll fight you. Making all the worst decisions that a teacher could make.
Yep. There's definitely times where you're like, man, If I could just say what I wanted to say right now, but then you start thinking about the news and the newspaper and how teachers end up in time. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
job security, right?
I mean, I can remember back even in first grade, I got in trouble for throwing like a spit wad at some other kid, and I got spanked in the hallway. And then I got spanked not only in the hallway by the teacher, but then I got spanked at home by my mom. So I got it.
Yeah, I got
it double there. And then today I was talking to my wife about this the other day. I mean, if you even breathe on a kid wrong, there's going to be a lawsuit.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yep. The way things are have totally changed. My dad, he recently was going through some memoirs of his uncle, and there was a story in there about, so this would have been, I don't know, back in the 40s, maybe even earlier than that, late 30s. And one of the kids in his class was causing all kinds of trouble, and the principal came down. He was like an ex-drill sergeant or something. And he grabbed the kid by the ears and just like boxed his head against the wall. It's like, holy cow, man.
You know, it's sad to say, but I think the world kind of needs some of that these days.
Yeah, there's times when a kid definitely needs more than just a stern look and a shake of the head, you know.
Yeah, but absolutely.
But we do the best we can, so.
Well, let's get into today's topic, because I'm really interested in this. I've always wanted a dog, but if I get a dog, I want to train it to do something. Like right now,
sure.
I say if I ever have a dog, right now we have like a 14-year-old Maltese that my wife got. And
okay,
it's old. It doesn't do anything, except now it's getting to the point, it's blind, it can't hear, it just poops and pees on the floor if we don't let it out every once in a while. And it's not fun. It's straight up not a fun dog to have.
Sure.
Now, I've always wanted, a lab or some other species that could potentially pheasant hunt, or I could go shed hunting with, you know, a shed dog, or, you know, something like a pheasant dog or something like that. But
right.
So what kind, just from a high level, what kind of responsibility does a gun dog need that's different, let's say, than if I got a lab just to have as a pet?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I guess if you're gonna kind of put gun dogs or bird dogs, however you want to say it, into a broad category, you know, say what's the personality of a gun dog compared to something like you mentioned, you know, we're just a regular family dog. And typically what you're going to find is a higher level of energy. Actually, Patrick, the guy who sends us out the articles here, Iowa Sportsman article assignments, he just picked up a Vizsla pup, and he's had Vizslas in the past, and Vizslas are probably the best example of that. Just a really high energy dog that's incredibly gifted for the field. But you know, when you own a dog like that, you have to have a basically built into your weekly or even preferably your daily routine, just regular exercise of some kind. You know, just to kind of let them get that extra jolt of energy out, you know, kind of like a toddler. It just sometimes has to get cut loose outside and go crazy, and then it's like, all right, I'm good after that 20 minute crazy run, you know. And so bird dogs in general, they kind of have that little extra energy need that you have to plan for, but also they're really pretty good with training, because another common thing that I think, and of course I'm biased, I own a couple of them, but I've seen it enough, I've heard enough anecdotal evidence from other dog owners. A lot of times gun dogs are just, they have an extra measure of intelligence, if that makes sense.
Is that genetics? Is that bred into them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, some of these gun dog breeds, you know, they're hundreds of years old, and a lot of them are from Europe and have been used for quite different hunting applications of what we use them now. But clear back when dog breeders then were trying to get together a good team of hunting dogs, those were some of those traits that they wanted, and they've, you know, continued on even now as these breeds have moved to the Western hemisphere and used for all of our American uses for gun dogs. That's a favorable trait that's been preserved in most breeds, and you know, some breeds have kind of gotten to be a little bit more showy, you know, and kind of gotten away from that. But really, that intelligence is a pretty common trait I think you'll find in most gun dog breeds.
Okay.
Which makes them fun to own, you know.
Yeah. So can you treat a gun dog like a pet still? Like, or does that animal have to be more disciplined and have more of a routine as, let's say, a dog that, hey, can the kids play with it? Can it, you know, will it play fetch with the kids? Can it go on walks? Or is this an animal that is straight trained to do one thing?
Sure. That's a really good question. And you know, if you are somebody that's looking to purchase a gun dog, you kind of answer that question for yourself right when you start looking. You know, you have to identify what your goal is for that dog. And if it's going to be a strict, you know, I'm shooting for this dog to be what would be termed a finished gun dog, well, then probably not so much of the playing with the kids, going on family walks, taking them along on the, you know, weekend trip to the campground type thing. They're kind of almost treated like just a well-oiled machine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They just function at the highest level of conditioning, and you don't want that focus, that drive to be, I guess maybe you could say, polluted by some of the other demands of life. And so a lot of the real serious guys, they'll definitely treat their gun dogs different than a regular family dog. But you know, if your goals aren't that lofty or that focused, then yeah, gun dogs can make great family dogs. In fact, that's definitely the class that my two gun dogs that they fit into. They're, you know, we call them gun dogs, but quite honestly, a lot of the time, most gun dogs are family dogs before they're gun dogs. And but if you're going to do that, then you definitely still have to be putting in that time so that they stay fresh on their training and useful once the fall hunting season rolls around.
Yeah. I mean, I've been around some guys who straight up treat their dogs like tools. They clean them. They train them. They put them. I mean, it's not like they're going out and playing fetch with them and saying, oh, good boy, you know, great, you know, good boy, you know, and like you would a house dog and sit there and pet it. Right. It's a tool. They've put this investment into buying this animal in hopes of it doing a job for them. And so they're doing that through like this strict routine, this strict training regimen. And yeah, so it's a lot different than, you know, a pet that just kind of does whatever it wants around the farm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so let's get into this article then. When you say 10 disasters to avoid with your gun dog, mm-hmm. are you talking about training this dog, like avoid during training, or just to avoid overall?
Well, I would say that the two kind of go hand in hand. I think it starts with training to then avoid these troubles in the field. And if I'm remembering correctly, or the first thing I mentioned in that article was a dog that is under control. So a truly trained gun dog. I think a mistake that, you know, a lot of, and this doesn't just apply to gun dog training. It can apply to, you know, somebody who's deer hunting and they're wanting to bow hunt for the first time and they haven't put in the practice and they walk out to go do a sit in a stand and they don't have the skill there to adequately perform, you know. But just that optimism kind of overrides better judgment. And that happens all the time, I think, with people who do buy a gun dog and they're like, you know, I kind of want to get around to training this thing, but I already pheasant hunt. My buddy's got a dog. I bet he can just kind of learn from him if we just take it out into the field. And that's kind of where you can start training bad habits and also end up in a really dangerous situation, you know, where a dog takes off or a dog crosses a road on its own, gets hit, or, you know, just basically anything you can think of, you know, getting sprayed by a skunk even, you know, now how do you get it home?
Yeah.
I think it starts with that. And some of the other problems then that I mentioned in the article, training can't fix all of them, but it can certainly help mitigate protect you from those risks a little bit more. Sometimes things are just happen. They're unavoidable, but good training is going to save you from a lot of it. So I would say that a lot of it starts with the training, but then, you know, as you get into the hunt as a handler, you have a responsibility. You know, it's kind of like when you take your kids to the store, you know, a little kid to the store, you try to teach them to listen to you when you're talking to them, or when you tell them to come back or something like that. But you still got to look out for the dangers. Once you're in the store, they could take off and run out of the parking lot or something. So I kind of view it the same way, I guess.
Gaia. So when it comes to training and the principles of maybe training a dog, are they the same across whatever you want the dog to do, whether it's pheasant, waterfowl, be a shed dog, I don't know, other things, like maybe be a police dog, or, you know, you want this dog to accomplish a task for you.
Sure.
Is the training regimen the same or different?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a good word to use here, not that training is a bad word by any means, I use it all the time when I'm talking about it, but when you really want to get down to the nitty gritty of it, is conditioning, you know.
Yeah.
And which brings us nightmares back to our gen psych classes in college, right? And Pavlov's hounds and and everything else, you know, but really that's how animals are trained. They're conditioned, and there's a desired behavior with an expected outcome. And so yeah, like you mentioned with the example of like a police dog, you know, or even some of the dogs used for like sniffing out bombs or drugs or something like that. You know, you notice a lot of those breeds are limited to just a few. You know, they have those genetic traits that make them most favorable for those roles, you know. So I guess you can condition dogs to do what you know, what the desired outcome is. And a lot of that is the same, but depending on the breed of the dog, it kind of factors into how easily they'll be conditioned to do those things. So for instance, when I was growing up, we always had golden retrievers, and I'm telling you, the second you have that dog off of a leash, a retriever, and you throw like a stick in the yard or whatever, they're going and getting that stick, you know. But now my Brittany, he has a natural instinct for, you know, locating pheasants and quail and, you know, settling into a point and waiting for me to come along and flush the bird. And, but if I, so training him in that way is easy, but to try and get him to retrieve something, that took a lot of work. You know, the first few times I threw something, he looked at me like something was wrong with me, you know?
Yeah.
and so it kind of varies, I guess, from, you don't really change maybe the technique so much, although sometimes you might have to, you know, change how you reward the dog, whether you're given more of, you know, if it's a puppy, you're probably going to use some Scooby snacks, right, to start out use that treat reinforcement, but with an older dog, it's going to probably be more of the physical and verbal praise and stuff. But different breeds of dogs are going to be a little bit more of a challenge in some areas, and they're going to excel more in some areas than other breeds. And so I think that kind of dictates your training, you know. And when you think about like you as in that role of conditioning your dog, you brought up the shed hunting dogs, which I just think is one of the coolest things, you know. And I have such a hard time finding sheds. I always wanted my dog to get it done for me, you know. but the probably the best shed dog trainer I know of is a guy named Jeremy Moore. He's up in Wisconsin.
Yep.
And he runs a Dog Bone. And he just talks a lot about how you have to train the people too. You know, we have to train ourselves. And a big part of that is just kind of reading our dog. And much like it is for me in the classroom with a bunch of students, you know, you have students that are capable of this, doing really well at this. Well, this student over here, maybe they don't do so well there, but they do well over here. You kind of have to work with strengths and weaknesses and, you know, start with those tried and true methods that work. But if they aren't getting through to the dog, then, you know, what's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah.
and so you, as a handler, you kind of have to then maybe step back and be like, all right, these normal methods that do get through with dogs aren't working. I'm going to have to take a different approach here and see how I can do better in order for my dog to do better.
Okay. Do dogs ever lose what they've been trained? Like, let's just say I trained this dog, right? From birth to, you know, 3 years old. And then all of a sudden for a year, 2 years, 3 years, I decide I don't want to be a duck hunter anymore or
right.
life gets in the way. And then I still keep the dog, but then I pick it up, you know, however many years later and say, all right, let's go. Do you think does the dog retain that information?
Yeah, that's another really good question. You know, that kind of thing has sort of happened with me. When I started out, when we got our first bird dog, I was, you know, watching all the training videos, reading articles and stuff, even I think bought a book or two and some training equipment. And, you know, I set a pretty solid foundation for my dog for, pheasant hunting. And and that's one thing that I've maintained through the years is I just keep pheasant hunting with him every year and do more work along those lines with him. But I also, like we were just saying, I wanted him to find sheds for me. And so I started doing some of that shed training with him, and I was doing it quite a bit. And, you know, like you said, life happens. You have a couple kids down the road and you kind of have to pick and choose what your focused hobbies are going to be. You know, it can't be split in so many directions. So I kind of backed away from the shed hunting with him a lot. You know, he wasn't making that progress like he did with the pheasant hunting. And I could tell it was going to require more intensive training for him just because it didn't really come all that naturally for him. I mean, he knows how to recognize scent and stuff like that, but just getting him to like get that permanent image branded into his brain of an antler and then connect the dots. You know, I was struggling with that. And so I kind of backed away from it, but on occasion, you know, it's interesting to bring this up. On occasion, I'll see him sniffing around at a shed that I got laying on a table somewhere, or maybe, you know, I'm moving stuff around and I pick up a couple of sheds or something and set them somewhere. Or I bring a couple home when I find them or something. And he'll kind of check them out, you know? So it makes me wonder, yeah, how much does he still remember? Now with stuff like maybe the waterfowl example or something, I think if they do that enough, and I think that like, we'll take an example here of a retriever, like a lab or a golden or Chesapeake Bay or something. That comes so natural to them that a lot of your training is built on their instinct. Right. And so I would say in the case of, if that happened to you, if that was your dog, you would have to go back and certainly work on some of those finesse skills, just kind of like almost those luxury skills, you know, for us as hunters. You know, turns out I don't really like to bend over into the water and pull the duck out of the water. How about I train you to hand it to me? Yeah. You know what I mean? And some of those more finesse skills, I think, can go away a little bit. But if you make that good foundation when they're young, lay that groundwork, they pick it up pretty quickly. Just last night, I had my dogs out for the first time in a little while, and I was just amazed at how quickly they were just repicking, you know, picking things back up and really impressing me with how much, you know, they retained since our last training session. And so, you know, I think we can give them, we can give them more credit than what we would tend to think we can, but you know, they're not infallible either. You know, they make mistakes and they forget things, and certainly regular time spent doing that training is so valuable. And I think probably where you'll end up missing out as the handler and as the hunter down the road is your dog will not have reached what they could have reached by the time their hunting years are done. You know what I mean?
Right.
They, because you had to kind of keep going back to the basics and just focusing on the basics, then, you know, that might mean two pheasants instead of a limit of pheasants each time you go out. Whereas had they had all that training, you know, man, you probably could have really racked up the birds through the years. So,
yeah, makes a lot of sense. All right. So let's break down this 10 disasters to avoid with your gun dog article. And the first one is untrained gun dogs. Let's just break down that little category first. What's that all about?
Yeah. So, probably a good story I could tell that goes along with this was, a guy that my father-in-law knows likes to come all the way out, lives out in the East Coast, likes to come all the way out to Iowa, Northwest Iowa, and pheasant hunt every year. He's got I think two or three bird dogs, and, he's an experienced trainer. You know, there's nothing bad to say about the guy by any means. You know, he knew what he was doing. He brought his dogs out, and he had a new pup that he kind of wanted to, you know, just show him around a little bit out on the East Coast. They don't have a lot of off preserve pheasant hunting, you know, so wanted to take advantage of every opportunity he gets, I'm sure. Brought his dog out on their way back. So probably 10 hours from where this guy lives, he let his dogs out at like a rest area, just to go to the bathroom and stuff, kind of air out the dogs a little bit. And what his youngest dog, his pup, took off, you know, like got on the scent of probably a raccoon or something, or a squirrel or rabbit, and just kind of like, boom, gone into the kind of forested area around the rest stop. Well, he like waited for hours, put out calls with the local police and stuff like that, and basically tried to reel this dog back in, find it. Couldn't find it, so they had to leave it behind because they had no idea where he was. And so went all the way back home. Well, then like a day later or something, somebody calls him up. I think it was the police department called him up because he left his number with him. Some lady had found this dog wandering around on I-90, you know, which is like one of the East Coast equivalent to like Interstate 80 here in Iowa, you know, just kind of wandering around just because he didn't have that reliable recall, which is the, you know, when you call your dog, they come. Didn't have that mastered yet. And the dog took off, got distracted, and, you know, really could have been a horrible situation. Thankfully, he was able to get his dog back and all was well. But those are really, when I was talking about that kind of a problem, truly a disaster, right?
You know, right.
That goes back to not having that foundation of the training done there. You know, another thing that we don't really have to worry about here in Iowa, but maybe if somebody was doing some Western pheasant hunting or even maybe some chukar hunting or something, places where there's porcupines or maybe some grouse hunting in the East, dog tangles with a porcupine. They never seen one before if they're from Iowa. You know what I mean? What's that big bushy looking thing crawling across the ground? Next thing you know, you have a super expensive vet bill, maybe a blind dog or something. And had you been able to keep control of that dog, keep him close to you, get him on that reliable recall, you could have stopped him from pouncing on that thing.
Yeah.
And you know, and of course, you know, there's skunk sprays around here or even tangling with another aggressive dog or something. You know, there's just so many preventable problems that go back to having that foundation of training established.
And that's kind of a good transition into the second category, which is injuries in the field.
Yeah, yeah. I can kind of lead this with another out-of-state hunt story. I don't know, maybe 3-4 years ago, my best friend and I, we'd just gotten done doing a day of pheasant hunting, and we were headed back to here to the Quad City area, and we stopped at a sporting goods store along the way back. You know, you can't resist that when you're in town, right? Got to go blow a few dollars at the at like Shields or something. But while we were in there, there was a couple of guys all dudded out in their blaze orange and their game vests and stuff. And so we kind of struck up a conversation, asked how if they'd had any luck that day, where they were hunting and that kind of thing. And they were from Ohio, and they had read an article in Field and Stream or Outdoor Life or something like that about how Iowa was like this kind of undersold pheasant state, you know. And so they were like, hey, let's make the trip out there. So the guy brings out his German Shorthair, and while they're hunting, dog just gets terribly hung up on thorns. I mean, really gashed her, and she's bleeding all over. And they had to and it's a Saturday, of course, you know, that's when all crummy things like that happen, right? When it's, right. When it's harder to find help.
Right.
And so they had to search around, being way out of town, and had to find a vet that could, basically emergency vet service that could stitch her up. And you know, I think that kind of ended their hunting with that, with at least that dog. I'm not sure if they had more dogs with her, but you know, that just got me thinking, how prepared am I for that? You know, after talking with them you know, probably one that's more common than even just getting ripped up by thorns or barbed wire, even if you're hunting a fence row or something. How many times have we all tripped over an old barbed wire fence that's, you know, buried in the grass or something? But things like their foot health, you know, stepping on those things, stepping on an old barbed wire fence, you know, we have boots on, that's just the pad on their foot, you know. Or actually, when I was doing a little shed hunting this spring, I had my dog out, and all of a sudden I just kind of noticed he wasn't like walking, you know, like all that differently, but I could tell there's a little hitch in his giddy up. And I was like, what's going on there? And I called him over, started examining his feet. Finally, turns out he's got one of those just giant cockle burrs, you know, the kind that just like get buried on you whenever you're like trying to pull cards in a trail camera or something. They just stick to you everywhere. He had one of those like wedged way up between his toes, and in between his toes and the main pad, the metacarpal pad on his front paw. And you know, it just got me thinking, it's like, if I was hunting, would I have actually noticed that? And the kind of, you know, it was really starting to hurt him. And he, you know, not just the damage to his foot, but to his shoulder joint and stuff, limping around like that. And it's just so important to keep an eye out for your dogs, because especially when they're bird hunting, you know, they're just so one track mind. They just want to go, that they'll kind of block that pain out and really start causing serious damage to themselves. And so, you know, checking your dog down after every hunt, that's something that I actually kind of learned from reading some of the material put out by another Iowan who's an excellent bird dog trainer, Bob West. He always talks about, as soon as you're done with your hunt, just give your dog a once over. Just go over everything. Just kind of give him that check down, just to find stuff like that. You know, you might find a cut, or you might find something that needs more attention, and you know, if serious enough, could save your dog's life. So
yeah,
let alone the hunt, you know. But do the
feet. I mean, obviously, the cardiovascular system, just like a human, if we want to compete, we have to do, you know, some kind of calisthenics or cardio to get in shape. What about a dog's feet, though? Do they have to be toughened up through training so that they can go and perform optimally at out in the field?
Yeah. Yeah. Dogs that are getting the right amount of exercise, it's going to help kind of keep their nails down a little bit. because those can start to get kind of long and can get snagged on things or even kind of cause them some foot pain. But also, yeah, the toughening of their pads, you know, getting almost like you said, you know, when you're in the heat of lifting weights or something for a sport, you get those awesome calluses on your hand. You feel like you could like just grab stuff out of the oven without an oven mitt, you know, just really tough hands. And that same kind of thing can happen with a dog's feet. You know, if they're getting enough exercise, they can, it doesn't mean that they're impervious to injury, but certainly they'll be able to hunt longer, maybe on a little bit rockier or more abrasive terrain. You know, especially if you want to do some Western hunting with your dog, certainly the feet have to be in good shape. Or even, you know, grazing them on some ice shards or something during a late season hunt, you know, they might hold up a little bit better to cuts and nicks and stuff like that. So,
yeah, this one I've seen firsthand, and it's hydration. I went out with a buddy and his the dog doesn't tell you he's thirsty because this is what I saw. The dog was just on fire that day, right? He just kept, you know, finding, kicking up birds, doing what he was supposed to do. And, you know, the guy who owned the dog probably just, you know, slipped his mind. I need to give him some water throughout this day. And it just didn't happen. So the dog kind of got weak and got tired, and he ended up having to carry the dog back to the truck.
Oh man.
Yeah. So we're, you know, he hydrated him and everything, you know, worked out fine. But how do you keep a dog hydrated when the dog can't tell you he's thirsty?
Yeah. Again, that's gotta be on us as the handlers. We have to, it's kind of like, again, you know, I often use the kid analogy when I'm talking about dogs, cause in fact, I think last night I started yelling at my kid like I was yelling at my dog. My wife kind of looked at me and like, oh yeah, wait a minute, I'm talking to a human here. But kind of like with your kids, you know, you gotta look out for their best interests. You know, sometimes you gotta check in with them. Hey, do you gotta, you know, take a bathroom break? Hey, do you need something to drink? Hey, do you want your coat? Are you too cold? We kind of almost have to take that same approach with our dogs because of the very thing you mentioned. They're so amped up, so wired to, you know, basically complete this mission with us. They're their best friend, right? And if we don't take care of them in that way, if we don't just pause the hunt, so to speak, and give them a couple gulps of water, then yeah, they're gonna run ragged. So a lot of times you'll see, if you're watching like hunting shows or something like that with bird dogs, an excellent tool just to bring along in the field, cheap, work great, easy to keep clean, is a Gatorade bottle. Those Gatorade squeeze bottles, we always used to use them at football practice or football games, have them on the sideline, and they're real easy to carry. You can whip them out real quick and you don't waste a ton of water. Whereas if you just use like a Nalgene bottle or something, you know, you're so much of that water is going to miss the dog's mouth, and how much are they really getting hydrated from it? But with the Gatorade bottle, you can just kind of pause the hunt. Again, that's where that underlying training comes in, right? Because they don't want to pause the hunt. But if you've trained them to come when you call them and to calm down for a minute, you can water your dog and then, you know, resume the hunt. Just from maybe like a hunting standpoint, like to not ruin your hunt, so to speak, you know, maybe kind of pull back from where you're at the time. So you're not watering your dog in uncovered ground yet. And through all that messing around with your dog, you're not scaring off roosters or quail or something like that. So kind of just pull back into the ground you've already covered. Pause the hunt and, you know, get your water bottle out and help your dog out that way.
Okay. And in the same category as that is overexertion.
Yeah.
Break that down.
That's kind of like what you're talking about with your buddy's dog there. You know, think kind of like the mild day in PE growing up, right? It always seemed like it was the hottest, most miserable day when everyone had to shuffle out to the track and run around there. And there were some kids I seriously feared for their life, you know. They're like crying, like grabbing their chest or whatever, you know. Probably because they were so in such poor physical shape, you know. And the same thing can kind of go in with what we're talking about with our dog's feet. If we're working them enough, if we're getting them that exercise that they need, then they're going to be able to stay in the field a little bit longer. And if we aren't, if they're too much on the family side of things, you know, where they're just kind of laying around couch potato dogs all the time, they're not going to be able to hunt very long before they start really risking damage to their muscles, their ligaments and tendons and even their joints, and then also their energy levels. You know, they don't have the maybe necessarily the best diet or at least the right balance of exercise to food intake, and as a result, you know, you could end up with a situation where they're just plumb tuckered out before you feel like the hunt should be over, and so you can kind of keep pushing them, and then you run into that problem where they're just shutting down and you got a long hike back to the truck and maybe even risking, you know, something if you factor in heat with it, heat stroke for them or you know, one of those kind of mechanical injuries I just mentioned, or extreme dehydration, muscle cramping, all those things. I'm probably not going to have, like, I mean, I'm not going to say it couldn't happen. If it's an older dog, it's going to be more likely, but maybe some heart problems as well. But yeah, overexertion is a real thing that can happen. And sounds like, along with the hydration problem, your buddy kind of had that with his dog. And that can even happen, you know, with a dog that is getting plenty of exercise. If you're just hunting them too hard without enough breaks in between, especially if the weather's not quite right for them, you know, a little hot, just take some of those breaks. Again, you got to be the one looking out for your dog, because like you mentioned, they're on fire, you know.
Yeah.
They're doing their favorite thing. They don't want to stop.
Yeah. And I think the next category, dangerous retrieves, kind of speaks for itself, but, you know, break that down as well.
Yeah. So kind of along with that thing that we've been talking about with, what dogs just, they're just feeling it, you know, they're find a lot of birds, they're getting all that praise that they're longing for from you, they're just enjoying the freedom and everything, but they also like getting their mouth on those birds, you know. They like finding them, they like finding them once we've knocked them out of the air and back onto the ground, and that's like their job, and they're wired to do it, especially if they're an upland bird dog breed, you know. Breaking a dog off of a downed bird is possibly the most difficult thing to do. But in this case, where it is a dangerous retrieve, you know, maybe that bird went down right near the mouth of like a badger den or something, you know, or maybe it went down near an active hornet's nest, or maybe it's down like a steep ravine or something, or the one I think of probably being the scariest thing is for waterfowl hunters, you know, bird, you wing a duck or something and that thing just swims out to the middle of like the river or the middle of the lake or something. And your dog doesn't do that calculation, you know, they're like, hey, down duck, I'm getting it, you know. And they swim all that way out there. And if it's been a long enough hunt or the water's cold enough, you know, they might start cramping way out there or just get too tired and not be able to make the swim back. And so, again, going back to that first point of having that trained dog, that's when it's going to be pushed to the ultimate test right there, is getting them to break that instinct of, I have to pursue this bird at all costs. And instead, do the boring option, listen to my handler, swim back and leave that bird in the water. And it's hard on you as a hunter, you know, because we like to think of any animal that, you know, we harvest, we take that very seriously. We don't like to just leave game in the field. And so it's hard on us too, as their handler, as the hunter, you know, but we got to think of the greater good here in that case. And again, step in the way for our dog and basically save them from themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's hopefully one that doesn't come up that often, but certainly can.
Yeah. A couple more, real quick ones here. Other predators. Have you ever had an experience, whether it has been a pheasant hunt or a duck hunt, where a dog's gotten in a fight with, and I'm thinking about Iowa here, like a coyote or a bobcat or a badger, yeah, or something like that?
Yeah, I had a close call once. I was hunting behind my male, Brittany, and we had hunted this kind of CRP patch along a creek bed. And it was a wide enough patch to where you could hunt it. I think, let me think here. It runs in the north-south orientation. So we hunted down the east end of it, heading south, got down to the end of that CRP patch. And we're like, all right, let's walk the other wide part on the western side of the creek here, heading north. And so we'd been by this place not that long ago, like this specific spot. And on our way back, my dog, he does a really good job of maintaining that good proximity to where he's not flushing birds way out in front of me that I'll never be able to shoot. You know, that's another important skill to teach your dog. And honestly, in this case, may have saved his life, because on our way back, this coyote popped out. He clearly was there when we walked by the time before, and he was kind of like, you know, this might be an opportunity here, because Brittany's, they're not really big dogs, you know, the biggest are around 50 pounds, you know, and certainly within, you know, certainly within the wheelhouse of something that a coyote could tangle with successfully. And sure enough, he pops out right when my dog's right by him. And I quick just rattled off a shot from my shotgun, you know, to kind of spook him off. You know, can't say, since he didn't attack him, you can't say that that's what he was doing for sure, but it sure seemed like he had calculated that one out and was going to make a go at it. You know, had my dog not been under control and been maintaining that close proximity to me, I don't know that would have ended in a favorable way, you know. And yeah, the same thing, a similar thing happened to a friend of mine who's been hunting a whole lot longer than I have. I think he had a Brittany at the time as well. And his Brittany was not, he was a really kind of a hard case dog. He was out a little bit too far from him, and kind of the same thing. He caught up to him just in the nick of time. There was a coyote waiting for him. And so I've heard those stories, you know. That's going to be the biggest thing. Bobcat populations do seem to kind of be on the rise here in Iowa. So
snake bites potentially.
Yeah. I had a former student. They had a dog get bit by a rattlesnake, in Illinois.
Okay.
You know, you don't really think of that in this part of the country, but happened, you know. So
yeah,
again, being there, keeping your dog close by and again, responding to your commands. But the bigger thing is just having you close by to kind of intervene for them. And if someone's wanting to do a hunt in some of those places where there's black bears or you know, even grizzlies or something, maybe you're doing kind of a high mountain. I think there's some, what are they, there's a species of grouse that can be at pretty high elevation. You know, you might start getting close to some grizzly elevations there, and
yeah,
you know, that'd be no problem for a grizzly.
yeah, that's a fact. And the last one on the list here is gun safety.
Yep. So we've probably all felt this before when we've done a hunt with, you know, you're going with a friend and they're like, hey, I'm going to invite this guy from work or something to go along too, and you don't have the heart to be like, does he know what he's doing? You know, yeah, is he gonna be like throwing lead at me, and is he like a safe person to hunt with? And so you're just kind of like, okay. And when that happens, and it's not just deer hunting or something like that, it's pheasant hunting and you got the dogs, that's something that always concerns me, because hunting with dogs is different than just hunting by yourself. You know, there's all these other things that we've just walked through, you know, all these risks that exist that if you're hunting by yourself, you don't ever even have to think about. Mm-hmm. And so, we'll take pheasant hunting, for example, anytime you see that movement in the grass, right? Or any kind of indication that there's going to be a flushing bird.
Yeah.
You know, you just, you're winging your gun up to your shoulder and you're ready to go. Well, if you hunt with dogs, you know that I have to basically give it an extra half count or, you know, a full second or something, before I pull the trigger, because maybe that moving grass is just my dog, you know? And so when I hunt with somebody, I think it's a really good practice to be like, to just, you're intervening for your dog here. So it could be kind of an awkward conversation, but you kind of have to say, hey, look, I don't know if you've ever hunted with dogs before, but, please, just be cognizant of the dogs, you know, give it an extra second when you see, you think something's flushing, just to make sure you're not going to throw lead at my dog. And, if you see a rabbit, that's another thing a lot of people try to do when they're pheasant hunting is, and I don't blame them, you know, I'd do the same thing where, you know, rabbit season's the same time as pheasant season and rabbit tastes great too. So you see a rabbit kind of bust out of a brush pile or something that your dogs are just working by. Now you're talking about shooting at something that's on the ground with your dogs. And so if they're not looking close enough, they might nail one of your dogs. So have that conversation, but then also practically, we all wear blaze orange for a reason, you know, when we're upland hunting, we're trying not to shoot each other. So I found some really cheap, blaze orange dog vests at a hardware store. And I just put those on my dogs along with, some blaze orange collars and that helps give them that little bit of extra visibility. You know, it's not perfect because sometimes the grass is, you know, way taller than they are. And so you still have to have that, I think, have that conversation of, hey, just please, keep an eye out for my dog.
Yeah.
You know, everything should work out well. Hopefully you in that situation end up with a new hunting buddy out of it too. So.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I interviewed a guy, this goes along with the gun safety, you know, a dog doesn't know, you know, where guns are pointed. They don't know if the safety's off or on, those kind of things. Right. So, guy, this is I think it was a waterfowl story. They get done waterfowl and everybody lays their guns in the back of this, ATV or this, side-by-side deal. Dog jumps back in. The safety's off, shoots the guy in his leg, and he ends up having to get amputated. The leg has to get amputated.
Oh, man.
So not only just that kind of what you mentioned, gun safety, but, you know, the other.
Yeah.
There's gun safety's under-talked about, to be honest with you. So it's very important to just know, you know, take your bullets out if you're not using them. Take, you know, always have it pointed in a direction where there's not a person. You know, I'm really strict with my kids if we're around guns or even when they're playing guns, you know, like, hey, you can't shoot them in the face, you know, like don't do that. You don't point guns at people, that kind of thing. So,
That's a really good point. Yep. The dog doesn't know. It's just a tool to him.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, Kent, man, I really appreciate your time, you know, hopping on and chatting with us today. Any other things that we should know or disasters to avoid?
Yeah. When I was putting this list together, I tried to come up with, you know, an even balance of what are the most common threats, but also some of the things that maybe hunters don't really think about, you know, kind of like with the predation one, you know, where your dog could actually go from the hunting dog to the hunted dog, you know, but some of those types of things aren't going to be as common, but maybe another thing you know, that after I wrote the article, I was like, you know, maybe I should have included was allergies. You know, sometimes just like people, a dog can have an allergic reaction to something. And if it's serious enough, you know, maybe it's a bee sting, or maybe, you know, just some kind of plant that they ingest or something. You really need to, if you're going to be away from home, which most of us, you know, when we go pheasant hunting, we are, at least to some degree, we need to have that backup plan in our minds for, you know, who we're going to call, and have that 24-hour vet emergency center, you know, figured out. Unfortunately, there's no pet 911, so you don't want to be stuck there trying to get a cell phone signal to look to Google nearest animal hospital. Just again, it's just part of that responsibility of looking that up and you know, just paying attention for your dog in that way. And you asked some really good questions today. I mean, I have a couple more articles that should be coming out soon on kind of like choosing a dog and how to start with the basics and stuff like that, that could kind of answer some of those questions when people are considering what dog to maybe is right for their family and how to set that good foundation. But, you know, I'm just a guy who kind of does it for a hobby. You know, here's probably one of the most important things I could say. If somebody's really serious about training their dog, you know, they want maybe a field trial quality dog, get professional help. Those guys, they've made it their life. You know, they've really mastered that skill of communicating and conditioning, communicating with the dogs and conditioning them to be a well-oiled machine out there in the field. And it's really an impressive thing to watch dogs of that caliber work. So,
yeah,
so definitely, seek out those resources. And we're fortunate here in the Midwest and even in Iowa to have a lot of those trainers very close by. So,
perfect. Well, Kent, man, thanks again for your time and good luck this fall.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks again for having me on the show.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.